has come to its end. I hope that you have enjoyed this one. And until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The Imam says, if you want to test your friend, do one thing. But be very careful in how you do it. Anger your friend. Yes, anger him. Tick him off. Get on his nerves. But of course, in an appropriate way. Don't do it in a negative way. And I don't want anyone tonight, after the majlis is going and creating fitna in society, saying, oh, the Sayyid said, anger everyone around you and your friends and test them. No, be wise about it. Look, friendship is very important. You want to know who your friend is. The Imam says one way, test him. You know, make him angry. Tick him off. Upset him somehow. And see his reaction. Observe his reaction. How he reacts will tell you what kind of a friend he is. Whether this is a good friend or a bad friend. If this friend, you know, يخرج من الحق إلى الباطل, as the Imam says. If his ghadab, if his anger causes him, you know, to lose his faith or to abandon the truth and embrace falsehood, to commit a mistake, that means this may be not such a good friend. Because friendship involves sometimes quarreling with another. He will anger you, you will anger him. This is part of life. The Imam says, if you anger your friend three times, and he does not say anything negative about you, you realize that he did not say anything negative, realize this is a good friend.
أنا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Welcome back to Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pariza. More than 4 months into the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip, let's look at some of the most recent developments. Grief and despair in southern Gaza. In the latest round of strikes, apartheid Israel has targeted Palestinian homes in Rafah, killing at least 14 people, among them 5 children and 2 women. Dozens more have been injured. This is the area the Israeli regime told Gazans to move to for their own safety. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejects a ceasefire proposal from Hamas and orders IOF troops further into Rafah. More negotiations are to take place in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. The United Nations has warned the risk of famine and malnutrition is increasing by the day in the besieged Gaza Strip as apartheid Israel's strict blockade has cut off vital resources. Gaza's health ministry says more than 27,500 Palestinians have been killed and at least 67,000 others wounded in relentless Israeli strikes since October last year. Joining me on today's edition in the studio, journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, and via Skype from London, student and activist Tarek Othman. Thank you both for being here. Fra, let me start with you. A ceasefire deal seems to be off the table, at least for the moment. Netanyahu says he's seeking absolute victory, quote-unquote, in Gaza. Any reaction?
I'm not surprised that there is no ceasefire because I don't think for one second that the Israelis and the Americans really want a ceasefire. Didn't they execute the second leader of Hamas, I think it was, in southern Beirut, and this was the person who would be involved in the negotiations for handing over the captives in Gaza. I think the only pressure that we're witnessing being placed upon Netanyahu is from the other members of his cabinet, who are even more extreme, more ultra-violent, and
Ben-Gavir
more ultra-right.
And Smotrich.
Yes, 100%. Yes.
Two names that come to mind.
And then the families that are pushing for the release of their relatives in Gaza. So they don't care how many Palestinians die, how many children are killed at a bakery or trying to get firewood or get water from a water tank. They don't care about Palestinian lives, but they do care about the Israeli captives that are held by Hamas. I think the only reason why Netanyahu is even talking about a ceasefire is as they corral the people in Gaza into Rafah. He's probably concerned that there might be collateral damage among the captives being held there when they basically take off the gloves yet again and go in and wade through bodies and wade through Palestinian blood in order to satiate their blood lust and revenge. And the fact that they want to... he has stated that he wants to release the prisoners.
Yeah.
And he wants to destroy Hamas.
Yeah.
And the only way he can possibly do that is by physically having the IDF go into Rafah, practically house by house, street by street, room by room.
Othman, how much do you think all of this has to do with Netanyahu wanting to prolong the bloodshed, since politically he is a dead man walking?
It's an interesting question, because I think whether it was Netanyahu or anyone else in the government, they do feel the need, the genuine need, not just out of self-interest, but out of a yearn for revenge and a yearn for an image of victory to defeat Hamas. Now, of course, Netanyahu is a politician that has always been uniquely concerned with his own survival, above even more so than your average politician would be, but his insistence on total victory, I think, from his standpoint, is a logical point, because what we have seen is a complete humiliation of Israel's military capabilities, of their intelligence capabilities, and a continued failure to achieve material gains over the past 4 months. Yeah. And Israel and Netanyahu need to come to a sense of victory, yeah, as well as, of course, Hamas needs to continue existing. So we're at quite a difficult impasse in negotiations, and it's just a question of who is going to flinch first and who is going to lose this war of attrition.
Exactly. And some are saying that this genocidal war has run its course. Now is the time for it to be brought to an end. And there seemed to be momentum 24 hours ago for that to happen, but it didn't. How has this breakdown in ceasefire talks, in these negotiations, been received in Palestinian circles?
I think many Palestinians were hopeful. I mean, there were images and videos of Palestinians in Rafah and other areas of the Gaza Strip after Qatar gave some inclination that there would be a ceasefire coming, and there were videos of them, you know, celebrating, dancing, singing, as you would expect them to do, because there were many that were perhaps hopeful that an end to their ordeal, the end to the genocidal campaign was closer and closer. Unfortunately, though, I think many Palestinians who looked at it logically weren't particularly surprised. I wasn't particularly surprised. And many Palestinians understand that there is unfortunately still a lot more that they have to endure before Israel is, practically speaking, brought to their knees.
I want to pick up on what Tarek said right there. Until Israelis are practically brought to their knees. It seems like they have. I mean, 4 months on, they haven't achieved any of their so-called stated goals. And it doesn't look like they will be able to do so unless it comes at the cost of everybody in the Gaza Strip either being killed or being pushed out of the territory altogether. Farah.
Well, I think that that's been the master plan in many respects all along. I mean, we're speaking from that type of objective from very early on. If we just witness what's happening in the West Bank, they're not just arresting thousands of people, and many of them under administrative detention, which is a form of internment without trial, but they are destroying people's homes, they are ripping up the streets, they are trying to make life uninhabitable and unlivable in the West Bank as much as they're trying to do that in Gaza. Yeah. So if you break things down and separate them out, I mean, if his stated aims were to defeat Hamas, they haven't.
Exactly.
But Israel's being replenished with weapons of mass destruction, ammunition, every day, air to surface missiles, all from America and all from Britain. Hamas isn't getting the chance to replenish its armaments to defend the people of Gaza against this barbarous onslaught. So that could simply be a time scale. I mean, Netanyahu said it was going to go on all the way through 2024. Yeah. I do feel there appears to be a bit of a shift, as if maybe the Americans in the background have started this clock ticking, saying you may get this sorted out with the, you know, Biden's presidential re-election being on the borderline in November.
Well, stay with me, gentlemen. You mentioned the Americans, and that's we could talk about right now, because despite fading optimism over efforts to bring the genocidal war to a halt, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says a ceasefire deal is still a possibility. He also says Hamas's response, quote, creates space for an agreement to be reached, unquote. Here's more.
We had an opportunity today to discuss with the Israeli government the response that Hamas sent last night to the proposal that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt had put together to bring the remaining hostages home and extend the humanitarian pause. What I can tell you about these discussions is that while there are some clear non-starters in Hamas's response, we do think it creates space for agreement to be reached. And we will work at that relentlessly until we get there.
Let me stay with Fra a little bit. And Fra, what do you make of those comments? On the one hand, you see the U.S., Blinken, pawning themselves as honest brokers. And at the same time, it's American taxpayer money. It's the U.S. diplomatic and political cover. And all kinds of support for the Israeli regime to enable it to commit genocide. They're practically participating in genocide in the Gaza Strip.
Yes, every bomb, every bullet, every tank shell is being supplied by either the EU or, more likely, by America. So they are totally complicit in every death, every injury, the destruction of hospitals, desalination plants, medical clinics, schools, nurseries. If anything has been shown through the events post October 7, it's that the mask has slipped. Finally, the world is able to see that America is partisan and always has been. Mm. Many people have said, many people who are politically aware of what's happening in the region have always known America has been behind us. Biden said many, many years ago, if Israel didn't exist, they would have to create it. So it's there to implement the foreign policy of the Anglo-Saxon corporate military industrial complex in the region. Mm-hmm. So they get cheap oil out and they get to sell expensive armaments to the UAE, Saudi Arabia. They keep the Ummah and the region divided through sectarian conflicts between Sunni and Shia, and to keep Christian from Jew and to keep Persians from Arabs in order to divide and conquer.
The old motto, the old ruse that's been used by imperial powers for centuries. I want to come back to that a little later and talk about complicity. But let me ask Tarek this one. Israel is supposed to be submitting its first report as mandated by the International Court of Justice to show how they have adhered to the court's ruling. Do you have any hope at all that they're about to do that? They would actually provide any of that to the court?
I actually did. I did at one point. So soon after the announcement, I was hopeful and I believed that something in Israeli policy had to change. I thought that surely now Israel would allow more aid into Gaza. Surely now Israel would allow aid into the hospitals, allow the rebuilding of hospitals, the rebuilding of medical facilities, the rebuilding of bakeries, and all such things. Surely now Israel would allow people to go back to the north of Gaza. Surely now Israel would begin to perhaps, you know, talk about prosecuting Israelis and Israeli politicians who have vocally and explicitly called for the genocide of Palestinians. And yet, here we are 1-2 weeks later, and nothing's happened. The report is due to be sent in within a month. And what we've seen is that nothing has changed, and Israel has, to my surprise even, has completely ignored those orders and continues to completely ignore those orders. Mm. And it seems like it's been very, very defiant in the face of the ICJ. And that's something that, honestly, I thought, and honestly, it's very humiliating to the international community and to those who still have a semblance of belief in the in the prospect of international law, as we've seen it entirely ignored by a state that is supposedly civilized, supposedly educated, supposedly backed by the freedom-loving, rule of law-abiding US and Europe. And it's something that has even surpassed my expectations, very low expectations for Israel.
And that's what I want to go back to for. So we talked about the U.S. and their complicity and participation in genocide. But then there are U.S. allies, namely the country we're in right now, the United Kingdom, and Germany, in complete disregard for their populations who have been protesting for several months now, week after week. If, on the question of plausibility at the ICJ, Israel is found guilty of genocide, then these countries that could have stopped genocide and did not will also be held accountable. Is that right?
That's if you believe in the rule of international law, if you believe that it will be imposed upon the countries involved. We've already seen different acts brought before different parliaments, like the British Parliament, where British soldiers have more or less been absolved of any war crimes that they may have committed in Iraq and Afghanistan and also in the north of Ireland. These people are above the law. They create laws for other people to impose on them and refuse to stick with the same standards themselves. I think it's important for people to realise that the likes of America have said that they would attack The Hague if it was to try and bring...
The Hague Invasion Act.
Yes.
That's what it's called. Yeah. Yep.
So they're outside of international law. They're above international law. And the three specific countries that you chose to pick there were North America, Germany and Britain.
Yeah.
Now, Britain was involved in 4 million deaths in, I think it was Bangladesh, 2 million deaths in Ireland through famine. I believe there was a famine in Iran that was caused by the English, although I don't know the full details of it. In North America, was it 40, 50 million indigenous native people that they put to the sword and put... made them go on forced death marches, yeah. And they put smallpox in the blankets, diseases that they had no natural immunity to, in order to kill them off. And I think it's Namibia that at the moment is in reparation talks with Germany. Mm-hmm. So the three countries you've specified that are coming to the aid of the genocidal regime in Tel Aviv, yeah, are all guilty of genocide themselves, along with the Dutch and the Belgians. Yeah. And the French. So all those people who see you, who talk about Europe being a garden, yeah, and the rest of the world
Joseph
being...
Burrell,
yes, and the rest of the world being a jungle. That's been echoed by Netanyahu. He's tried to tell people in the West, because that's the audience he's speaking to, yeah, that we are standing up for Western values and Western civilizations. Mm. And if we fall, you will have hordes of angry... jihadists, yeah, knocking on the door of Europe and North America in order to attack the people there. Total lies, just like no 40 babies being beheaded.
Definitely.
And now there's even talk, were any UNRWA members actually, yes, in the kibbutzes in southern Israel, as claimed by the Israeli government?
Lies and more lies, that's for sure. With the embattled Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu rejecting any ceasefire deals, the anger on the streets of London is only increasing. Mona Shahada, a Palestinian activist, was out protesting with her 4-year-old this past weekend in solidarity with the children of Gaza.
I'm here because I want to tell Rishi Sunak that we are not useful idiots. When we say Palestine will be free from the river to the sea, we mean that every Palestinian who lives from the river to the sea deserves to live in freedom and dignity. And if they have been dislocated from Palestine in 1948 or 1967 or later, they deserve to return to their land. We are not useful idiots. We are the voice of justice and dignity for Palestinians and all the oppressed. It's such a shame. It's such a shame. And that's why we will keep coming and we will not be silenced till the killing and the genocide is over. I want him to learn when he grows that we stood on the right side of history and we stood against genocide. This is for him to know that I did my duty as a mother to him and put him on the right side of history, even when he was 4 years old. And because children his age and younger are being killed every minute in Gaza.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned of the dangers for those caught up in current conflicts. And he highlighted the situation in Gaza as an example. Have a listen.
And I'm especially alarmed by reports that the Israeli military intends to focus next on Rafah, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have been squeezed in a desperate search for safety. Such an action would exponentially increase what is already a humanitarian nightmare with untold regional consequences.
The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres there. Farah, let me get your reaction to Secretary Guterres' comments there. The UN has seen its credibility tested and its agencies brought into the tug of war between nations, as you mentioned UNRWA a little earlier. Speak to that if you can.
I think as part of the ongoing kind of genocidal program that's being carried out upon the people of Gaza. I think the very fact that we've witnessed that the Israelis won't let medicine in, they won't let fuel in, they won't let water in, they won't let food in. They're using starvation, hunger, dehydration and disease
as a
weapon of war. Now, I think they want to move the people from Gaza out. And if the Egyptians won't allow that, and then all this nonsense about sending them off to Gambia or wherever these other countries are, won't happen either. So I think what they want to do, because they've talked all along about people not voluntary transfer.
Yeah.
So you get to the point where you've destroyed the whole of the north, you've destroyed the middle, they're going to destroy Rafah. It's just, you're going to see it happen in front of your eyes. Like, you know, I mean, there's a set military objective here. Each time moving people from the north to the center to the south.
The master plan, as you said earlier.
Well, and it would be my belief that they are deliberately targeting UNRWA by defunding it so that it can't come in afterwards to rebuild the hospitals, to rebuild the schools, to rebuild the infrastructure, to rebuild the desalination plants and bring in solar panels and to give people a sense of hope going forward. So I think there's been a deliberate ploy to attack UNRWA. They've attacked the UN all the way through this, saying they're anti-Semites.
Mm-hmm.
They're supporting Hamas,
Absolutely.
That Israel's just playing the victim, as always.
As always, UNRWA does the right thing, it gets defunded, Israel commits genocide, it gets away with impunity. Tariq is still with us, of course. And Tariq, your thoughts on where you think these recent actions leave the Palestinian push for statehood?
It definitely all depends on how this war ends. If Israel is allowed, it's continued to be allowed to partake and commit genocide with impunity, then Palestinians have no chance to achieve independence and any real semblance of state. But if Israel is defeated, and so far it has been defeated, so far it's still unable to achieve even a semblance of victory. If Israel is defeated, then Israel is then left with no choice but to do what, you know, is left with no choice but to commit to a two-state solution. And I think what is what the world has begun to see, and what Israel will eventually begin to see, is that Israel's policy of domination over Palestinians, Israel's policy of denying Palestinian national self-determination, denying our freedom of movement, denying all rights to us as a people, has failed. And here is Israel back in day one, in a lot of senses, committing what is, you know, after 75 years of normalization, 75 years of ethnic cleansing, it's still in the same position it was 75 years ago. And I think David Cameron was actually, making the same point, that Israel's last 30 years have been a failure, despite all its efforts in normalization, all of its efforts towards economic security. It's failed to deal with the Palestinian issue, as they might phrase it. And so Israel will be forced to take a different path, I think. But what remains to be seen is whether it, and that, but that will only happen if it fails in Gaza. The question is, will it fail in Gaza?
And that is a valid question, Tarek. Thank you very much. We are going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. Farag Hughes and Tarek Othman, thank you both for joining us. And thank you, everyone, for keeping us company. Gaza under attack. We'll be back. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
The United Nations has declared that Israeli attacks on Rafah in southern Gaza could result in large-scale loss of civilian lives. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says Israeli attacks on Rafah in southern Gaza on the border with Egypt could lead to large-scale loss of civilian lives. Jens Lerke, a spokesperson for the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said, "To be clear, intensified hostilities in Rafah in this situation could lead to large-scale loss of civilian lives, and we must do everything possible within our power to avoid that." He added, "Under international humanitarian law, indiscriminate bombing of densely populated areas may amount to war crimes." Jens Lerke, a spokesperson for the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, was speaking in Geneva, Switzerland. He said, we can warn what might unfold with the ground invasion, and we can make clear what the law says. The Israeli regime has pressed on with its genocidal campaign and threatened a new ground assault on Rafah, where over half of Gaza's 2.3 million population are now living, mostly in makeshift tents. About 1.4 million people are sheltering in Rafah after being ordered there by Israeli forces, which previously described the area as a safe zone. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, recently reported that intensified Israeli bombardment from air, land and sea continues across much of the Gaza Strip, resulting in further civilian casualties, displacement of the population and destruction of civilian infrastructure. The UN Humanitarian Office said the influx of thousands of internally displaced persons into Rafah was due to intense fighting in Khan Yunis, combined with reports of an increase in strikes in Rafah on Monday and Sunday. In its latest aggression, the Israeli regime killed several people, including two children, in a new airstrike on the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Elsewhere in southern Gaza, the Israeli army targeted the vicinity of Nasser Hospital, that's located in the city of Khan Yunis, which has been the focal point of Israeli strikes in recent weeks. In separate attacks on the same city, at least 11 people lost their lives. The genocidal war against Gaza has continued for over 4 months now, with a death toll approaching 27,600 as of Tuesday, 6th of February, many of those women and children. Also, a senior commander of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned the Israeli regime that endangering Iran's interests anywhere in the world will not go unanswered. Brigadier General Abbas Nilfurushan, the IRGC's deputy commander for operations, said, "The Israeli regime should know that we settle our score with our enemies on a daily basis. We would not leave unanswered whatever action the Israeli regime dares to take against our interests anywhere in the world," Nilfurushan asserted on Tuesday, 6th of February. The top IRGC commander said, "The Islamic Republic is the most prominent missile and drone power in West Asia region," noting that the region's geopolitical configuration has changed based on Iran's power. He also said the United States is incapable of protecting the Zionist regime like in the past. He added, "So the Israeli regime has resorted to the strategy of war between wars, or war in the grey zone." He said the main goal of such a strategy consists of attempting to weaken the constituents of Iran's power, such as the Islamic Republic's nuclear, missile, drone, and regional might. Nilfurushan identified the main principles of the strategy as engaging in intelligence warfare and retaining the level of war beneath our threshold of tolerance. As a means of confronting the strategy, the top IRGC commander said, Iran has attached special importance to intelligence protection. Also, the leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah resistance movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, says the recent rising aggression by the evil trio of the United States of America, Britain, and the Israeli regime against Yemen will not affect the determination of the Yemeni people to support Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. The leader of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, made the remark in a televised speech on Tuesday, 6th of February, to commemorate the 20th martyrdom anniversary of the former Ansarullah chief Hussein Badruddin al-Houthi. Badruddin al-Houthi was killed whilst leading a revolt against the then Saudi-backed regime in Sana'a in 2004. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the late Ansarullah leader promoted steadfastness and sacrifice in the face of the US invasion and colonialism, and reaffirmed the necessity of unity and confronting the conspiracies targeting Muslim nations. He praised the courage of the Yemeni people in the fight against the global arrogance and threats from the hegemonic powers. He said, Our nation today is a very great nation with the most important geographical locations, which enjoys very enormous economic resources. But it has been shackled, he said. The Ansarullah leader underscored Yemen's firm stance in supporting Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. He said Yemen will continue to launch retaliatory strikes on Israeli-tied shipping in the Red Sea, despite rising aggression by United States and Britain. Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, "The United States terrorizes most countries, most of their leaders, and most of their armies with the language of threat and intimidation. What is the position of our Islamic nation in comparison with the Arab world and elsewhere, who are hundreds of millions regarding what's happening today in Palestine?" He added, "Our beloved people, despite the fact that after the aggression that lasted 9 years and has not ended yet, took a distinguished position. We set out to confront the evil trio of the United States, Britain, and the Israeli regime, and we are ready for the sacrifices, and we are confident of victory." He stressed that Yemen is a free country which cannot be influenced by US hegemony. He said, "If we had been followers of treason and connivance, the Americans and the British would not have carried out the aggression against us." Abdul Malik al-Houthi said, "No matter what the evil trio does, it will not affect our position and it will not break the will of the Yemeni people." He vowed to back the Palestinian people and their cause until the very end. Turkey's Anadolu News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The United Nations Humanitarian Office has warned on Tuesday, 6th of February, that everything possible must be done to avoid intensified hostilities in Rafah City in southern Gaza Strip, which may lead to a large-scale loss of civilian lives. Jens Lerker, the spokesperson for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, told the United Nations briefing in Geneva, Switzerland, he said, "We can warn what might unfold with a ground invasion, and we can make clear what the law says. And under international humanitarian law, indiscriminate bombing of densely populated areas may amount to war crimes." He added, "So to be clear, intensified hostilities in Rafah in this situation could lead to large-scale loss of civilian lives, and we must do everything possible within our power to avoid that." The Israeli regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, recently announced that Rafah is the Israeli army's next target in a press conference, claiming that Rafah is the last remaining stronghold of the Palestinian Islamic Resistance group Hamas. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza announced on Tuesday, 6th of February, that at least 27,585 Palestinians have been killed and 66,978 others injured in Israeli attacks on Gaza since 7th of October last year. The Israeli offensive on Gaza has left 85% of the population internally displaced amid acute shortages of food, clean water and medicine, while 60% of Gaza's infrastructure has been damaged or destroyed, according to figures by the United Nations.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah min ash-shaytanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and with the beautiful name of Allah, we start this program. Islamic upbringing, where we try to tackle and present the answer to many of your questions and challenges that you bring up by writing to us at englishradio@irib.ir. Here in the studio, we have Sayyid Salman Naghawi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa International University. Previously, we've been talking about two parenting styles, transactional and transformational styles. And then we went to talk about the qualities or traits of transactional parents. We mentioned one in the previous program, which was parents just paying attention to their own image and they want it to be reflected in their children. And in this program, we have in the studio our dear guest. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
We're really eager to find out the second, third points about transactional parenting.
Yes, so as we mentioned, the first point that we want our children to behave in the way that we imagine them to be, in the mold that we want to make for them. As we said, that it's okay if it's even the mold that we have may be correct, may be appropriate, but still we can't enforce it. So as an extension of the first point, we make rules. Dictatorial rules, we could become authoritative. We want things to be done.
Exactly, we want them done.
We want them to be done, not because of, again, it's our feeling. It's our feeling that it should be done as we want, as it wanted. It's not for the sake of Allah. It's not for the sake of the betterment of that person. So we enforce those things. We want things to be done. Now, the child who is faced with such a situation, with all those feelings that are coming in and out of his mind or her mind in that age, there's a great deal of, as I said, strains and pressures from within out, and there's an extra burden that my parent wants me to do this, and it's either my way or
the highway.
So now the teenager will start, instead of, you know, doing things, making the decisions and doing the things the right way as it ought to be done. He either wants to please his parents and he accepts their commands and does them, or even he does it out of compulsion.
To get the satisfaction and the attention of the parents.
Of course, he's dependent on his parents at that age. He's not. He knows that if he doesn't go by the book, if he doesn't follow the rules, he's going to be
deprived of so many things.
So many things.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about transactional parenting, how the parent becomes a dictator and just aims and wishes and wants to have the child to transact a certain act in the way, in the framework that he or she provides. That was the second point. Any other explanations you would like to provide on this, or you would like to go to the third point?
I think that's enough. We go to the third point, and it's an extension of the second point, that now children, the parents who want to enforce their commands and their dictatorial rules and regulations, they have to impose them and become overbearing upon their children. They have to, you know, show their fatherly, motherly figure and show that we have the authority to do this. So you need to accept what we are saying. So it's you want them to completely submit to our will. Instead of submitting to Allah's will, we want them to submit to our will. If we're not, we need to be satisfied, we need to be pleased. Not because we are pleased if our children follow and submit to Allah's will. We need to be happy about that. But now here, it becomes a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the child feels that this is something which my parents want, not because Allah wants it. They think of doing it because of making their parents happy, as you said, or pleased. And now...
And sometimes the parents think that this is what Allah wants.
Yes.
And that's why they keep enforcing it on
their
children.
That's the way they justify it for themselves.
But it's so hard, I mean, to draw the red line, the border line between...
It's difficult, yes. We need to remember, my daughter or they should behave properly, follow keep the hijab, the covering, or even boys take proper clothing. Now today, it's very difficult with all these fashions coming in. Every day there's a new fashion, there's a new trend. It's very difficult to, you know, stop them. But you can't, if you want to make them, force them to stop doing so, that will brew resentment and hatred within you, and your relationship with your child will be ruined.
Right.
It won't be a healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It will not be an enduring relationship.
Right.
So this is transactional. It will be just to get things done. The child will say, okay, we do it for the sake of it, because it has to be done, so it'll be done. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to transform him. It's not going to make him a leader. It's not going to make him an independent thinker.
It's like just you're clipping their wings. And they will be a very big, mature bird, but with no wings to fly. Because all along the way, the path of upbringing, every single day you try to take one feather from their wings so that they would abide by your rules and your regulations, so you feel that you're in command.
Very good. That's a good way to present it. The clipping of the wings had to be done in the second stage, the second 7 years, when they were supposed to be slaves or obedient servants.
Right.
That was the right time to do so. Now isn't.
Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. We're talking about two parenting styles. So far, we've mentioned two points about transactional parenting, the result of which is having submissive children and submissive adults. It's good to be submissive, but not to just to be a yes man, just to, you know, carry out whatever orders other people, you know, tell them to be around. And imagine them and their roles that they have to play as spouses in the future, a mother, a wife, a father, and a husband. That would be very ugly, because such a child grows to be an adult, that would be a very weak and coward and dependent individual.
And he'll be or she'll be doing the same things with their children.
Exactly.
That vicious cycle will go on.
Right.
So number one, the problem is that you see them in your image. Number two, you enforce rules.
Mm-hmm.
Number three was that you want overbear upon them, impose them in a very dominating way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fourth thing that what happens is the relationship becomes very stagnant, very stale. It becomes every day, it's just an everyday routine. There's no fun about it. There's no jubilation in it. There's no making being happy and confident. And you're rewarding your child, and you're always, you know, pushing him to do things with better results.
Just it's like robots.
It's mechanical. It's a mechanical relationship.
Right.
Okay. Get up in the morning, have breakfast, go to school, come back, homework, whatever. So this is something which becomes, I mean, it has to be done that way, but the child should be doing it out of his own free or her will. Own free will, independently thinking this is the best way to do it.
I mean, the result is a very depressed child. I mean, the way you describe it brings a lot of gloominess to my mind.
Yes. And sometimes then the child remains okay, good behavior at home, but when he goes or she goes out, then she's free to do whatever she wants.
Mm. That's the tricky part.
That's the tricky part. In front of you, they're very good, submissive.
A hypocrite.
But outside,
God knows what they're doing.
Yes.
And they're not even close enough to you to come and say, you know, that who they're befriending, what they're doing. They expose their true selves in the society when they are with their friends.
And today it's not in going out. Even in under your nose.
You're totally right.
Completely out of control.
Exactly.
So this is basically the transactional way of parenting, and basically the point is, number one, is important that it should, all of whatever we, the relationships which we manage, whether with ourselves or other human beings, our children, especially our children, it comes under the overarching relationship with Allah.
Mm-hmm.
This is very important.
As a parent, I should keep that in mind.
In every relationship, because unfortunately, you know, today even when ulama scholars talk on the pulpit, and they want to say, "Oh, there are some rights that human beings have; so there are rights which Allah has," they are brought together in a parallel way.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not that way. The rights of Allah. We say Allah Almighty will forgive His rights.
His rights.
But he will not forgive the rights of you. He is the one who's given the rights to the parents.
Exactly.
And it is because of him that my parents have those rights. Bil walidaini ihsana has been said by Allah Almighty.
Exactly.
So basically, it's because of submission to his will, because of his love, that we need to respect our parents.
Right, totally right.
So basically, and also we have a responsibility, as you said, qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara. It's a responsibility given to me by Allah Almighty. So it is in His submission, for His pleasure, yeah. I seek to do this.
Right.
I want my child to become as submissive to Allah Almighty,
right.
Not to me.
Exactly.
Yes, he is submitting to Allah Almighty. But when it comes to the role of being the imam, as we talk about the imam,
mm-hmm.
in the society, yes, we have to obey his rules.
Right.
Because when we're talking about praying, fasting, whatever, that's obedience to Allah's rules.
I'm going to be an ambassador.
Yes. But right. When I come into the society as an imam, as a community leader, then I have to enact my own rules as the leader. Yes, I also, my flock, the people who are going to follow me, they need to do what I say, right. Again for the sake of Allah.
Right. Thank you so much for these insightful points, which brings us to the end of another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing. We would be more than happy to have you to write to us any questions or comments at englishradio@irib.ir and visit our social media at Call of Islam Radio. This is our Insta and Facebook. Thank you so much. Take care of yourselves. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Short short wave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.